number 948306.
Mr. Templer, Reel 6. Mr. Templer, what were the conditions like in the trenches as you went up the line?
Well, whenever I had to go up the line, either as an orderly taking messages or whether I had to go with as an orderly to an officer, the communication trenches actually were deep enough for you to walk along. They were probably, 2'6" wide, and had certain protection. They wound about a bit to prevent any long open space overhead, but they were always very wet. The duckboards continually had to, when you trod them, they tended to sink under you, and therefore you got rather muddy and wet. But in a lot of places there had been it turned into a quicksand because the duckboards gradually sunk under it, and other duckboards have been put down, and sometimes cases of biscuits have been dunked in to see if they could fill it up, you see. But it was very wet and just plain dug trenches, not sandbagged on either side, not those, because in any case the sandbags would rot, you see, and collapse. So it was a straightforward digging job, and you had to go up as far as you could, and then when you got to any of the first front line, you had trenches either side of you going in other directions, you see. But unless Jerry was shelling you, it wasn't too bad. You just got on with it as part of your job.
Was it your battalion's responsibility to maintain the trenches?
Well, I came under the supervision of the people upstairs. It wasn't for us to tell them when a trench wall wanted repairing. That became part of the organisation of the battalions and the division, brigades. So that those sort of things were catered for by those in higher command, you see.
But who would actually do the work?
Oh, mostly the working parties from our own battalion, you see. That was their job, as supporting the brigades. There were three brigades, and supporting the brigades and doing repair jobs for the forward areas, you see. And we lost a lot of men doing that sort of thing. Anyway, it was a very muddy job always, and there was one occasion when a working party had been up the line and came back to dugouts on the canal bank for their meal and a rest in the early morning. There was a young officer posted to one of the sections, one of the platoons, had just come out from England, and he hadn't been up the line with them, but he'd spoken to one of the senior NCOs and said that he would like the men paraded, and that they should clean themselves up and their buttons and that sort of thing, so he could inspect them for the first time. So the platoon concerned was told to clean themselves up, and they'd only just come back from up the line. And there was one man who always was regarded as rather foolish, you know, one of those silly fellows who always a bit of a butt, you know. And he hadn't bothered himself about cleaning himself up. His tunic was muddy, and he was muddy, and his buttons were dirty. And the young officer walking along the line and said, tell me, what did you clean your buttons on this morning, to this silly man? And the fellow stood staring straight ahead, and he said, parapet paste, sir. And the officer blushed and passed on quickly, and nothing more was said, but it went round the battalion afterwards about this fellow who told the officer he cleaned his buttons on parapet face. The poor officer had never been up the line before.
So that was his way of having a dig at the officer.
Yeah.
At the present stage of the story, we're on the Somme, and it's winter 1917. How do you manage to keep warm?
I don't know, I forget now, but it, we did keep warm enough. We had braziers very often in the dugouts. You know, oil drums with holes punched in the side and filled with fuel of some sort, coal or coke or wood or something like that.
Was it easy to get hold of fuel?
Oh, well, there was always ways and means of getting something to burn. You'd be surprised where it all came from. I did.
So it didn't always come through the supply train?
No, it doesn't matter, did it? You got what you wanted. Oh, we were warm, a bit uncomfortable, a bit damp, but that didn't make any difference. When you're young, you seem to, and you're doing something, you forget a lot of these things.
Could you tell me about your daily routine?
Well, there wasn't. Obviously, there was a routine, but all these things were varied according to the circumstances. Signalers were together. There were a certain number of signalers together always in the signals dugout, and there had to be someone in attendance on the telephone to receive calls from the division and sometimes from brigades. But the duties seemed to adjust themselves. If you were on night duty, you served a certain time, and you woke whoever was your next one for duty. You'd tumble him out of his bunk and say it's 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, or whatever time it was. Now you get on with it. I'm going to have a nap. And so it gradually worked in some sort of routine. But we got our food at appropriate times, and the whole thing was a matter of understanding between the various members of the section, you see. But to say routine, well, you were always liable to a little bit of change very suddenly, you see. There was always something happening.
What sort of jobs would you have to do during
Well, our jobs consisted of listening for the call on the phone, you see. And that was done by the field telephone buzzers. We had a buzzer, and we had someone sitting probably with earphones on his ears, and the call sign for the battalion was GL Emma. See?
What sort of messages would be sent? What were the messages about?
Oh God, I can't remember. Speech was the. It was only by speech. We never used the Morse code to send messages, because speech was more difficult to pick up by any sort of ground detection on the part of the Germans. They had some means of picking up messages. So that the buzzers were very little used except as call signs, because a penetrating buzz could be heard quite easily.
Did you know anything about this German system for intercepting messages?
We only suspected. We didn't know, but I think they had some idea of ground wireless, you see. That was the thing that was developed during the war. We were introduced to it in about 1917, I think, we were told about it.
So Britain had it as well?
Well, Britain got the idea that you could transmit underground by using what they called a power buzzer. And the forward areas had their earth pins out, about 4 or 5 earth pins and a receiver. And the headquarters would buzz out single word messages, or in code sometimes, but messages like that. And they would be picked up without a telephone wire. And it was my first introduction to wireless as such. It was done through the earth. Whereas now we know that the atmosphere carries the messages. You see.
If there was a risk of the Germans intercepting messages, how were confidential messages sent?
Well, I assume that's where dispatch riders came into it, because we had dispatch riders come up with messages direct to the colonel, which were obviously of a confidential nature. And that would be one of the essential ways of getting it through to him as a confidant, because anything that came through over the phone, then obviously the signal section knew all about it. And if there was something that wasn't to be generally known, the only way to do it would be for a dispatch rider to take it direct to the officer commanding.
Was there any use made of coded messages?
Very rarely, I should think, because the facilities for decoding messages were a bit difficult under the conditions that we were operating then.
Did you have code books and that
no.
sort of thing?
No, we didn't have any. So that it, well, if there was any coding to be done, it was by directly by between the overall command and the officers commanding the unit. They would, if there's anything to be done, they had to do it in their own, under their own control, either way.
Did the traffic in messages increase when you got close to some action?
No, it was very little communication except by runner then, between the colonel and the companies, you see.
So in fact,
well, you see, we only had telephone lines then, and if they got busted, you got nothing. And you couldn't always repair them when you were under those conditions. So you had to have, you had, the signallers had to go as runners. That was their job.
But in the days and weeks leading up to,
if you were stationary, you got your telephone lines. If the unit was stationary virtually, then you had telephone lines. Or if you were in a position on which your stationary part was the headquarters, battalion headquarters, you were in communication with by telephone line to the division. And I don't think there were many messages of any great consequence which were transmitted that way, because I think they all probably, if it was a very secret move on, they would use dispatch riders to deliver the message direct between division and the commanding officers. I'm only hazarding that because I never got anything confidential, seriously confidential myself.
So you never had any intimation as a signaller that something was about to happen?
Well, you got inclinations by the various types of movements that were made. That was the only information you got. You got no direct information, so you only you gathered signs and portents, so to speak.
So it's early 1917. You're on the canal bank near Ypres. What happened during that year?
Well, of course, the artillery, field artillery particularly, was massing quite close to us, just on the west side of the Ypres Canal, opposite to our dugouts. And the artillerymen were sent up there with their batteries and limbers and ammunition and all that sort of thing, but they had very little shelter. They were more or less having to sleep on their ground sheets under their guns, because the rain at that time was colossal, and the whole area of the front right up to the German lines and probably beyond, the rain was so bad that the whole area became very more or less waterlogged, and yet the higher command kept sending men over the top there, and the bombardment was pretty considerable on both sides. It was at a time when rain seemed to be affecting even the cloud formation, and it continually rained. It was the wettest time I ever remember. And
what are your recollections of the Passchendaele?
Not very much, because I wasn't right up in amongst the front line at that time. I was at my job with the battalion headquarters. And in that respect, of course, I was a very lucky man. I didn't know it when I enlisted that I should have anything quite like that. But the point was, I accepted what I got and was grateful, so to speak.
Was your job any different as a signaller? While there was an attack going on, were you busier?
No, it didn't make a difference. You simply had adjusted your duties and your periods of duty according to what was necessary. And the continual bombardment was very, very, very bad. And the only surprise it was to me that the high command kept throwing men up into the front line and over the top under those conditions, because they were frightful up in the forward areas when I went up there. You know, the water was there on the surface all the time, really, and the people up front must have... I think there were a lot of people with trench feet at that time up there through the excessive wet and that. And, of course, when people... There was a period when people were sent home with trench fever, you see, and it was very bad. and I have every reason to be grateful that I wasn't one of those that were in that predicament. I was better off than a lot.
Was there any sort of jealousy of your position?
No. People knew that what had happened. We'd volunteered for a job, and the job we got was either good or better than we'd expected. You see? It wasn't a question of anybody. They might have been a little bit envious and say, "You lucky buggers," you see,
but there'd be no real resentment.
There was no resentment. They knew we got a job to do, and they got a job to do, you see. And theirs was probably the worst one. But, you see, it's the ultimate that is the terror of two ultimates that there are. When you're a soldier, you are either faced with surviving all right, or you're surviving maim, or you're dead. You see, and if you come to that point where you're dead, you're finished anyway. In my case, it was left to me for later in the battles that came afterwards, that I was nearly dead at a later time than most of them, you see. That's the difference. And I'm the only explanation I can give you. I'm not trying to make myself out to be a hero all the time. The point is that in the army, you do what you're portioned to do, and you do it the best you can under the circumstances that you're doing it.
You've mentioned that during Passchendaele German prisoners were taken. Did you see any of them?
Pardon?
You've mentioned that German prisoners were taken.
Oh, they were, yes. There were prisoners taken, and they'd be brought back. They'd have their servants with them, you know, the batmen. And sometimes you see them standing there in their jack boots and making their batmen get down on their hands and knees and clean the mud off their boots. Very rude things about the officers, the German officers, autocratic little bastard.
So the German officers weren't very well liked?
Well, I don't know that all our English officers were liked, you never know, do you? I can't answer that one.
What was your impression?
But they were a very autocratic crowd anyway, especially those who had Prussian extraction, you see. And but there when we moved down farther south toward the end of 1916, there were a lot of prisoners came to our hands then, German prisoners.
Did they appear to be well treated, or did they get fairly short shrift?
Oh, I don't know. They seem to be, you know, average soldiers in many ways. I can't tell you. I remember coming out of the away from the Somme and Thiepval front when we came out of Lille at the end of 1916. I was sent on an advance party to fix up some camp or billets for the troops when they came out of the line, and we were sent. I had several men under me, and we got to a station. The railway station at Doulon, and we were a bit short of grub. We'd got emergency rations and not much else, and we wanted something else to eat, so I and another one of the chaps that I had with me went into the town from the station and went to a shop where there were a lot of women buying from the local épicerie, I think they called it, you know, the general shop sort of thing. I tried to buy some bread, and I tried to buy anything that was edible, and they were very, didn't want to know. And I thought, well, I don't know, we've got to get some grub somewhere. We've only got our biscuits and hardtack, you know. So I started spinning them a yarn. I told them about Beaucoup Allemand prison there and Beaucoup Allemand mort, and we had been in the fighting up, you know, at the Thiepval. And they suddenly thawed. The idea of plenty of Germans being killed was delightful to them. So we got supplies of bread and one or two tins of stuff, and I went back, and we spent the rest of the night on the concrete platform at Doulon, wrapped in a blanket. In the morning, we had to use the then sanitation arrangements of the French railways, which consisted of a large slab of slate with a hole in it on which you stood and larger trousers, and hung onto a rope that was suspended above you with two hands, and relieved yourself as well as you could there, you see. And it was obviously very infrequently cleared out. It was extraordinarily bad to go, but you were glad you were hanging on the rope, you see. But that was my experience of French sanitation.
So it wasn't on some mains drainage?
It wasn't on the main drainage.
Did you form any impression when you saw the prisoners as to whether they were well-equipped, well-fed, generally in good condition?
I can't answer that one with any degree of certainty. The point is that when you've been taken prisoner, I should think it's a very depressing feeling anyway. And they didn't look particularly happy at being prisoners. On the other hand, you can't tell whether they were happy as soldiers either. So that it's a very difficult question to answer. In fact, you can't answer it satisfactorily. I don't know how British troops looked when they got in the hands of the Germans. You see, you've got to compare something, and you can't.
Were you able to compare their clothing with the clothing you had?
Oh, well, they seemed to be reasonably well clothed at that time, as far as I know. I didn't examine them. I was only too bloody glad to see them being marched away, you see. They were out of it, and they were, I think, probably happier because of that than we were.
So the German prisoners were out of it. Were you ever tempted to get away from the signals battalion?
No. What about, do you mean the fact that we had an opportunity of joining the observer corps?
Oh, that's right, yes. Could you tell us about that?
I see. Well, we were somewhere outside. I think in a division we must have been in the acting as a support to the division in the line, because we were at a place called Dickiebusch, which was not far from Poppering and all those areas. And the battalion orders were posted up each day. And on this particular occasion, the battalion orders contained an offer to volunteers for the kite balloon section, observers were sent up. And anyone volunteering for that type of job would be given a commission. Well, John and I were talked about. We got the papers from the orderly room, and John and I were sitting outside where we were encamped, looking at the kite balloons that were around the salient. And while we were talking about this matter, a German plane came out of a slight cloud and opened up with machine guns on all the kite balloons all round the salient. You see, it was that way, coming along and around that way. And it went round one after another and fired on the balloons, and they burst into flames, and we saw the observers being tossed out of their gondolas without parachutes and just falling down. They were going down and falling down and obviously going to be killed on impact.
Were parachutes available at this time?
I don't think so. They couldn't have been, or else the men would have warned them. So we were watching this, and we decided that it was better to stop where we were and deal with the dangers we were used to, rather than take on a job which would probably end in immediate death.
Were there any sort of anti-aircraft defences for the kite
of... Oh, there were anti-aircraft guns, but the point is that when the balloon is ablaze, the occupants are either wound down quickly before they fall out, or else they get tipped out. And that's what happened. We could see the poor buggers dropping. And so we said, no, I don't think we'll do it. We tore the papers up and forgot all about it.
It sounds as if they were fairly well undefended.
Yeah, they couldn't be defended very easily. Whether they eventually, I expect they eventually had parachutes, but on this occasion you could see the poor buggers dropping in through the air, just like, you know, stone.
So that would have meant a transfer over to the Royal Observer Corps?
Well, we should have just been transferred to the Royal Observer Corps and been trained for that sort of work. However, we decided to stop where we were, and we also said that we'll wait till one of us gets knocked out, and then the one who remains can do what he bloody well likes.
What sort of thing would you have done if you were able to do so?
I never thought about it because it didn't arise. No, you can't have these conjectures of what you might have done. It's what you did do that matters. Don't forget that I was interested in very much more in John's sister than I was in him to a certain extent, except that he was a pal of mine and I would look after him.
So,
twitch it off.
Right, you weren't tempted towards the kite balloon section?
No, I didn't want it at all. I'd sooner be shot at on the ground than shot at up in the air.
What else happened in 1917? You can...
Oh, we heard about the fact in 1917 that the Russians had virtually capitulated because of their revolution, and the effect of that was to come in a few months hence. But we were told about it. We were also told about that one time, usually when we were on route march. The colonel would tell us from his GG, get us all up close and tell us what had happened, that we were taking over some more of the line down south in order to relieve pressure on the French troops, because they'd had some trouble with theirs, some sort of mutiny or other. So that towards the end of 1917, I came home on leave again, but that was virtually with the memory of the Passchendaele battle in my mind.
What sort of effect did those two bits of news have on you and your comrades, the Russian Revolution and the problems
well,
that the French had had?
Well, we knew all about the effect on the line wherever we were. It seemed as though it was a bit of a tragedy for the Allies, but it's no good. You can't think about what it'll do to you because you'll just have to do what you're bloody well told. And that's how it happened.
It seems that the pressure on the British army was going to be increased from two directions.
Yeah, well, it was from the French needs and for the obvious difficulties of the warfare at that time. So we came home on leave towards the end of about November or October or November 1917. And I found days, I hoped, eventually, when I told her that I was in love with her, and I hadn't told her, that I could have some hopes. And she didn't altogether contradict the thought, because she was always the one who happened to be sitting near me wherever we went, to a theatre or a party. There she was, alongside me, and John had had one of my sisters alongside her, you know, him, and... So it went on, but Days obviously wanted to be near me, and I just couldn't say, you know, anything, because I didn't know. I didn't know whether I would survive.
When you were back on leave, how were you treated by people in general? Would you get concessionary tickets to the theatre, that sort of thing?
Oh, no,
people
we had... Everybody rallied round. My parents worked for a company in Baker Street, and they were the caretakers there, and there were a lot of girls who, when John and I came over, were only too anxious to take us to theatres and things, and there were probably my sisters, John's sisters, and umpteen other girls, and we'd get nearly a row in the orchestra stalls with John sitting on one end and me sitting on the other with Days alongside me. And then they paid for us for the theatre, which was fairly reasonable, and then we took them all out to tea afterwards. And it was on one of these occasions that we barged into a restaurant not far from Kingsway,